So I've read a lot of books on self-help, on how to improve yourself, and I've written several of them too. And I've read a number of books on coaching, on how to help other people, and I've written one of those as well. Today's guests, Jacqueline Lane and Scott Ossman, have, along with one of my teachers, Marshall Goldsmith, written a book about how to become coachable, how to prepare yourself to work with a coach, to get what you want, to grow in ways that you want to grow, to live more in alignment with your goals and values. And they are funny, brilliant, kind, wise, and really accessible authors. The book is wonderful. If you have thought about getting a coach, this is a great investment, $20 and a few hours of your time to get the most out of working with that coach. If you are a coach and you want to think about, like, who are the clients that I really rock with, that I really add value, this book will give you clarity about that. And if you're just thinking about how can I set myself up to be more open to taking action, to vulnerability, to risk, and to really playing hard in this game of life, I think the book will be useful for you as well. And I hope you will enjoy this conversation. So, without further ado, Jacqueline Lane and Scott Ossman, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Great to be here with you, Howie.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're so subdued now. We were just cracking each other up for like 10 minutes, and
we'll get back. We'll get back. Yeah.
Now,
no worries.
Now we're behaving. Don't behave for my audience.
Oh.
You guys have collaborated with your colleague and one of all of our mentors, Marshall Goldsmith, on a book called Becoming Coachable. And I wanted to talk about that today. I didn't think I needed to read the book. I thought I was going to read it because, like, I like you guys and, like, okay, you're doing it to
Thank
kind of
you.
grow, for marketing and a business. And it turned out to be a really important, useful book in my life. So here's to the blessing of low expectations, but it really blew me away. It's such a beautifully written book.
Oh,
Mm,
thank you
thank you,
so much,
Howie.
Howie. I really appreciate that.
So I got to ask, why did you write the book? It's kind of a weird title, topic, like becoming coachable, like preparing for someone to do something to you almost. And I'm wondering, like, where did the concept come from? Who did you write it for? And what was at stake? Like, what was the need in the world that you wanted to address?
It's such a great question, Howie. And the book really came from an insight that Marshall had. And I think he got it from Alan Mulally. And I think the insight was the most important part of coaching is the quality of the person being coached, the readiness that the person has to be coached. And if you start with a good coachee, you can have a great outcome. And that really resonated with us. And when there were a bunch of different books that we were thinking about writing to make our contribution to the world of coaching. I mean, here we built 100 coaches over the last 8 years. We have the agency, which is now 4 years old. And we thought, well, we know something about coaching. And we started looking around and we realized there was no book out there that helped someone prepare for being coached and what it took to become coachable and to even recognize, like, what should you be expecting from the coaching process? And so we went out to all of our friends in the agency and the community and started talking and having this conversation about being ready to be coached. And those were the insights that formed sort of the basis of the book. The first part of the book talks about, like, how to prepare, what are the sort of the blocking and tackling of finding a coach and what to expect and all that. And then the middle part of the book is what it takes to become coachable. So it really, the response has been wonderful. And it feels like we did fill an empty space.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of your book, Howie, with Peter Bregman, You Can Change Other People. And I would say our book is similar, except it might just be titled You Can Change Yourself.
Right.
You know, it's actually
And you
changing.
should.
Yeah.
And you should.
You should. Change is really
Yeah.
hard. And this is the guidebook, to help us all navigate that so that we can continue to be the best, fullest versions of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the sales jobs you do at the beginning is to really remove any stigma around coaching, which I wasn't, I was sort of aware that there still is some, but when you point out, like, you know, I think there was a Warren Buffett quote about self-improvement, but basically, I even wrote down the quote. I wanted to get to it. It's on another page. But basically that if someone tells you to get a coach and they're willing to pay for it, that's a huge compliment. It's not like you're broken, fix yourself, but man, you have potential and let's unleash it.
Right. Exactly. And the Warren Buffett quote that I love this because someone asked him, what's the best investment you can make? You know, of course, and Warren Buffett's such a legendary investor. And I love this question. His response was, from all I can tell, the best investment you can make is in yourself.
Yep.
And I think that says it very simply. I completely agree that if your company is invested in your growth, that's a huge sign of the value that you create and their belief in the potential that you can do even more. I think of Whitney Johnson's work on continuing our own S-curves of growth and continuing to disrupt ourselves, that's really part of living a full life, is continuing that journey and always realizing that we can be better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But boy, that middle of the S is such a nice place to rest for 8 seconds.
Feels so good there, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's ironic that the reward for getting better is more demands.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
So it's about, you wrote about preparing yourself for being coached. I would wouldn't it be true though that anyone who gets a coach or is looking for a coach is already prepared? Like where do you see the gap between people saying, okay, they come to the 100 Coaches Agency and they say, I'm looking for a coach. It sounds like they are prepared for a coach. Where did you see the gaps?
Well, yeah, it does sound that way. But I can tell you, look, I looked for a coach for 4 years and never found the right coach. And it wasn't until I actually found the right coach who said the right thing to me that I realized the reason I didn't find the right coach is because I wasn't ready to be coached. So just asking for a coach, like that's sounds like the first step. But we talk about this in our book. We call it the openness framework. In my case, the first step to becoming coachable was being open to change. And the issue that I had is I would meet a coach. I would talk to them. I met a lot of coaches. I was in the world of coaching. I was running a coaching community. And I would talk to coaches and I'd say, I should have a coach. I'm looking for a coach. And they'd say, great, what do you want to work on? I'd say, life's pretty good. I'm pretty happy with the way everything is going. And, I can't think of anything to work on. They said, well, if you can't think of anything to work on, then, I can't help you. And then I found a coach and I said that to him. He said, well, why don't we work on expansion? Why don't we work on growth? And I realized that as I was talking to all these other coaches, I wasn't open to change. The kind of the dark side of everything is good is I don't want to change. We don't say it that way. We don't hear it that way. But when you do, you realize that. So, if in order to become coachable, you have to be ready to change something in yourself. Otherwise, there's no point to coaching. That was my revelation. That was the first. So that became sort of the first sort of step in our openness, what we call our openness framework, was being open to change. And the second one is Jacqueline's hurdle.
So the second in our openness framework is being open to receiving feedback, right? And, my experience of feedback, especially from corporate America, was that it always, when someone said, can I give you some feedback? Immediately I would have this visceral reaction and just kind of steel myself for
it's
the worst.
Punitive.
I'm about to be told something that I really don't want to hear. And of course, even just that attitude and energy made it very difficult for me to hear any feedback or to receive any feedback, positive or negative. And the big shift was realizing that all feedback really is a gift. because not only is it informative, it tells us something. Whether we agree with the feedback or not, it informs us about how someone else perceives us and their experience of us in the world. And especially if we're leaders, understanding our leadership from someone else's perspective is incredibly valuable. And so just being open to hearing that, having an attitude of gratitude and thankfulness for that, you know, as our friend Marshall would say, just say thank you. Don't grade the feedback. Don't judge the feedback. Don't say, that's fantastic. Thank you so much. I'm going to do it. You just say thank you. Because if you start essentially responding to that feedback, then you're telling someone what feedback you like and don't like. And it makes them less likely to give you the feedback that you don't like in the future. And so just a, just a very neutral thank you so much is all that's required. And so that became the second step. And of course, in the coaching process, you have to be able to hear feedback of all the people around you if you want to, again, make any real change. If you want to continue to improve, especially, again, if you're a leader, your actions and choices are very consequential. And so being open to hearing that, and a coach will help you through that process. But you have to at least understand that that's part of the coaching process in order to be coachable.
Yeah. Let me follow up on that before we get to three and four of the framework. So I was talking with Peter Bregman, our mutual friend Peter, the other day, and he was talking about how feedback is so often weaponized in organizations through processes like, you know, annual review, performance review, various types of things. And he's kind of pulling way back on feedback and moving much more towards feed forward, you know, advice for moving forward. And yet when you talk about, and you have stories in the book about leaders who were open to feedback, who were curious. You have a Richard Branson story, you have an Alan Mulally story, and there's something almost jaw-dropping about people at that level, with, you know, the 600-pound gorillas or the 6,000-pound gorillas in their cases, where everyone is going to be deferential to them, to see them acting in such a weird way, to be humble and inquisitive and curious. And I'm curious, thinking about that and Peter's observation about how corrosive feedback can be, do you find that the leaders that you coach, when they get good at feedback, that that can transform the organization into a more open, more learning, humbler organization?
Yeah, Howie, you're pointing to two key factors about feedback, both of them so important. Number one, the head of the organization setting an example that they are open to feedback can transform the organization, right? Because without feedback, our blind spots remain blind spots, right? The flow of information ceases. And I think Alan, I think it was Alan who said, like, the worst thing in an organization is hidden problems. This is, you know, as great leaders, we can solve any problem that we know about. But if people are afraid to tell us the problem, then we can't do anything about it. Right. And I think that's the other side of feedback. And I agree with Peter, feed forward better. Feed forward is really just feedback that you get and you can do something about in the future, as opposed to feedback, which is something you did negative in the past. So, you know, we kind of think all feed should be feed forward. But again, great leaders are yearning to hear the things that they need to hear to be able to lead better. Mm-hmm. Right. And they realize the hardest thing, that's one of the hardest things they ever get, because I mean, I think we all know when we're in a position of authority, getting people to tell us what we need to know that they feel puts themselves at risk is very hard.
Right.
Right. If you have the power to fire somebody, getting honest feed forward from them, feedback from them, just a simple review from them is complicated. Right. And so as a leader, you really have to create a safe space that allows you to get the information you need to be able to lead properly.
Yeah. And I think it's also about what you do with that information. Right? Mm-hmm. That as some organizations, they treat feedback as punitive. And it's often, you know, a slap on the wrist. But if you're using that information as the way that Alan Mulally or Hubert Joly used that kind of information, that feedback, that feed forward, they're using it to make real change. and they're not, you know, and when someone comes forward and shares a challenge or shares an issue, you know, the story goes that Alan Mulally would applaud and say, thank you so much for sharing this, right? That how much more powerful that is rather than, oh, well, you shouldn't do that. You know, so it's all about the culture and the way that an organization treats that information as well.
Yeah. So if someone comes to you and they want to be coached and they're open to change, and I think there's a big difference between being open to change for the results it's going to get me and open to the process of what I'm going to have to mm-hmm. go through in order to get there. But let's say they're sort of dancing on the edge and you're like, okay, I think they can become more coachable. Like one of our jobs as a coach is to tenderize people to feedback or mm-hmm. inoculate them a little bit. So, you know, the way I understand feedback as criticism is that it triggers our neurological fight or flight. Our brains can't tell the difference between that and a saber-toothed tiger.
Mm-hmm.
So as coaches, how do you help people put out that fire a little bit so they can train their mind to distinguish between something that's going to bite their neck and they're going to mm-hmm. bleed out versus a bunch of words that are relevant to how they've been performing?
Hmm. I love that. You know, it's, I love how, what you're saying is, feedback is a metaphor, right? So you're saying historically people think feedback metaphorically is the equivalent of, you know, a lion or tiger, and it's going to bite you. I think that the shift becomes feedback as a metaphor is your dog, right? And if feedback is your dog, not a lion, then you're like, oh, I do this. I'm getting the information I need to be able to make the changes that I need to make, right? It's a gift. It's loving. Feedback, I think you can interpret all feedback as a loving friend instead of as something that's looking to tear you down. And I think creating that shift in your mindset, in your metaphorical mindset of what feedback really is the shift that you need to be open, really open to feedback and to be able to receive it. It's what Jacqueline was saying before. You say thank you when you get feedback. You let people know that you are appreciative of the gift that they have given you of being open and honest and a little vulnerable. Because mm-hmm. look, whenever we share something with somebody that they may take the wrong way, there's a certain amount of vulnerability that we're putting ourselves at to do that. So it really is a gift. And if we can see it that way, then we can, you know, at least lessen that fight or flight.
Right. And the interesting thing about feedback, this is what Marshall points out, is just because someone gives you a piece of feedback doesn't mean you need to do something with it, right? Receiving feedback and committing to take an action on it are very different things. And just receiving the feedback well and saying thank you is often enough. Sometimes people just need to share their perspectives, and that can be informative. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to commit. You're not beholden to that feedback. You don't have to make all the changes that other people are suggesting. But just creating that safe space is often enough to even begin the process of their perception changing.
Mm, gotcha. And another thing that you talk about in the book a lot, that we're all familiar with here, mm-hmm. but is not widely known in the outside world, is stakeholder-centered coaching, this whole process. Mm-hmm. And in what ways does that help people receive the feedback? In fact, you're sort of training the people around them to provide the feedback in a way that is most assimilable, consumable, and helpful. So can you talk a little bit about the interplay between the coachee and the people who are going to give them feedback and the coach?
Right. Oh, I think a lot of stakeholder-centered coaching, if people are curious, you can read Leadership is a Contact Sport, which is a great article by Marshall. And what I love about that is it points out that the more you follow up with your stakeholders, the more their perceptions will change. not only will you change, but their perceptions will change. And interestingly, perception shift is even harder than making a change personally. And so it's the process of picking one thing that you'd like to work on and saying, I want to let other people speak before I give my opinion, right? Maybe that's the one behavior you want to change, right? And there's a whole load of benefits of that, but let's just say that that's the behavior. And you go back to your stakeholders and you say, thank you so much for some of the feedback that you provided to my coach in the 360 assessment. I am working on letting people speak before I share my opinion. And I'm going to check in with you every month just to hear like quick 30 second to 1 minute conversation. I just want to hear, how am I doing? And do you have any other suggestions for me? And just the process of following up with your stakeholders every month for, let's say, 6 months or a year, you start to see massive measurable change, not only in that behavior, but in people's perception of it.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. It really, I think that whole approach is a testament to how important leadership, how much leadership depends on followership, right? I mean, a leader, what's that quote? A leader
without followers.
It's like is a guy walking in the woods. You know, there is no such thing as leadership without followers. And so the stakeholder-centered coaching process really brings the the followers front and center into the coaching work.
If you'd like a more colorful metaphor, my grandfather was an actor and a band leader in the Yiddish theater in New York. Uh-huh. And one of his lines was, you know what the conductor can do with his baton if the orchestra doesn't show up?
Wave it around. Just wave it around.
Not what he was thinking, but yeah. Again, before we get back to 3 and 4, you talk about like just the impetus for the book was this idea that great coaches look for coachable clients. Like that's almost a secret. And there's a little bit of a cheat code in there. Like, you know, like the best surgeon wouldn't go looking for the easiest surgery. Like, you know, someone who just needs, eyebrow tweezing versus open heart surgery. So to what extent do you feel, what is the coach's responsibility versus the client's responsibility? And where do they overlap and where does one end and the other begin?
It's such a good question. I think it's a bit of a spectrum, right? And certainly those people who come to a coaching engagement and are already very coachable and have done some of that pre-work and have really examined themselves and are, you know, show up with the humility to hear feedback, the willingness to create change, that's a really powerful way to start an engagement. And those engagements get off the ground faster. But even some people who come to a coaching engagement with a little bit of skepticism, a little bit of doubt, oftentimes a great coach will naturally take them on this journey and help them open up and help them become more coachable. Do they still get to some of the same places? Absolutely. It just takes perhaps a little bit more time for things to get going. But I do think that a great coach understands that this is often the very first step. If someone's not already coachable, that's really the rapport that they're building and the process that they're beginning in just the first few months together.
Yeah. I think it's also worth pointing out, I mean, we're coaching at the most elite levels. The highest level executives and some of the most important organizations, governments. And all of the coaches that we're working with, their ambition is to create impact. And their modality of creating impact is by by supporting great leaders to become even more effective, right? Better leaders, having more impact on the people around them. We all know that all change is going to happen in the coach. The coachee is responsible for all change, full stop. Like the coach can't make somebody do anything that they are unwilling to do, right? So 100% of the change is going to happen from the person who's being coached. The job of the coach is to open up as much possibility for that person as they can handle, and to create as much expansion for them as they possibly can, because it's a, you know, it's a real multiplier effect. Like when you help a leader become a better leader, there's a whole ecosystem of people around them that have, that are more effective, more productive, live better lives. And so, but that's the interplay between the two. And when you make, you know, again, in our role as an agency, when we match people well, we get the most effective outcomes.
And there's something about, the coaches, at least that you quote in the book, and some, many of whom I know personally, and certainly Marshall, there's a kind of a no bullshit boldness that I think can be very, very useful. I don't know if you guys saw the Netflix series Coach's Playbook.
I have. Mm-hmm. I love it.
So I can't remember his film, Patrick Moglia, the tennis coach, who was flown to work with Serena, and mm-hmm. she was basically, you know, disrespecting his time. And, you know, like the first thing he had to do if he was going to help her was say, no, this is absolutely not going to be like totally risk blowing mm-hmm. the engagement, losing.
Right.
And so like one of the things that coaches have to be willing to do is get fired, right? You
absolutely.
say, your coach will challenge you to hear things you do not want to hear and do things you do not want to do. Like, you know, why am I going to pay someone to do that for me?
Mm-hmm.
How do you help clients be prepared for that in advance so that when it happens, it's uncomfortable, but it's not a divorce?
Yeah.
it's a great question. Part of what we tell people is so we always recommend three different coaches for someone to speak to. We think that's a really important part of the process because, you know, much like, let's say buying a home, you don't want to just buy the first house you see usually. You want to take a look around and get a sense of what it is. It's a big undertaking. It's a big purchase. If you're with coaching, you're investing in yourself. You want to make the right investment, and you want to have someone that you feel like you can trust and be in the trenches with. And so, of course, that trust element becomes really important, especially when they're finally starting to tell you some things that are really uncomfortable and you may not really want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the process, though, meeting three different people, there may be three different styles, right? One person is going to be a little bit softer, perhaps, in the way that they deliver feedback. And someone else may be a tough love type, right? And for different people, different styles resonate. And that's a little bit of an opportunity for them to decide what kind of style or approach do I like best, and who is it that I feel like is going to be my person in the trenches with me, who's going to shoot me straight.
Yeah, I think also it's a little funny. I think everybody thinks they want to hear all those hard things about themselves. because going into it, they don't really realize what they're going to hear. So it seems okay. I think of some of the people that our coaches have coached who are going like, I'm looking forward to my, I'm speaking about myself right now too. Like I'm looking forward to my 360. I can't wait to hear what people have to say about me. It's going to be delightful. Because you don't know. Like, you know, people aren't telling you the things you really
need
to hear.
They're called blind spots for a reason.
Right. And then you hear them, and it's humbling. And it's shocking and maybe even a little depressing. But once you get through that period of deep, dark depression of hearing all this truth about yourself, you come out of it realizing that there's lots of things that you can now work on and change.
I think it's liberating.
It's eventually liberating. For a moment, it's a little shocking, and then it's liberating. Because the other thing that you realize, and this is really the advice that we give everybody going into it, is just because you don't know about those things don't mean they don't exist.
Right.
And that's the worst part, is things that are out there that exist, that are holding you back, that you're unaware of, and therefore you don't even have the choice to change. I mean, look, you can decide to hear something and it's a barrier and you're like, I'm not going to address that right now, or maybe ever, but at least you're making the choice, right?
Yeah.
When you don't know about it, you don't even have the choice.
Yeah. It reminds me of a Stephen Wright line. He says, everyone who believes in telekinesis, raise my hand.
Right.
That's awesome.
It's like if you don't think it's your hand, you can't raise it.
If you don't
own the levers of change, then it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Also, there was a great quote in Ted Lasso, and I don't remember who said it originally, but it was quoted by the team psychologist saying, "The truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off."
Yeah. I love
that.
I love Dr. Sheridan.
Yeah,
that's a great
quote.
Great TV show.
And that reminds me of Scott, something that you wrote in the introduction or somewhere in the book. Mm-hmm. You talk about the benefits of finally, you know, getting coached after you had become coachable. It says, not just because I grew as a person, but because I learned I could grow as a person. So that speaks to something beyond, a meta, beyond like the specific growth that happened.
Yeah, absolutely. So I went from being content to recognizing that whatever I believed was my limit was a self-limiting belief. I mean, that was part of my coaching experience. So if I said, you know, whatever my expectation of growth for the company was or for myself was, anything at all, in and of itself, that was self-limiting belief and was stopping me from the expansion that was possible. And that was totally liberating. All of a sudden, I didn't have to even think about what the limits were, because limits are irrelevant for me. Right. I just had to think about like what was possible and then move in that direction and see how far I got. And that has been a really substantial change for me and hopefully a positive change for the people around me.
Jacqueline, what do you think?
Can attest.
So far, so good.
So far, so good. Yeah. You know, and I think what I saw change with you, Scott, was realizing the untapped potential in other people too.
Mm-hmm.
That it, you know, essentially liberating yourself of some of the constraints, but really allowing our team to step into the vision for the company and the organization, the future, created even more expansion than any of us could have anticipated, but it allowed each person to really shine in their own way and bring their own brilliance to what we do. Mm. So it's been a really amazing journey. Yeah. And, you know, I think I love that our entire team is now also going through that process of coaching and learning and developing. There's just so much more that's possible when we are each functioning at our highest, but we're united by a core set of values and a clear mission. We'll see. Time will tell.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard a lot that, you know, you can't love someone else more than you love yourself. I don't know that that's true, but I think there's something about you can't see someone else. If you're limiting your own potential, it's very hard to see other people's sky's the limit potential.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
So true.
And I sort of want to double down on this. The insidiousness of it for me was I thought that I was setting pretty audacious expectations for myself. And what I learned was whatever lines I'm drawing are limitations. Even if you think you're drawing lines that are pretty far out there, you're still limiting yourself by drawing those lines. And like Jacqueline said, we don't do that for anybody anymore.
So what's the difference between, you know, goals and limiting lines? So if I say, okay, I want to grow our revenue to X, or I want to expand into this market or whatever they're trying to do, you have to kind of have something you're aiming for. How do you create the goal without turning it into a limit?
Well, I think that you can have directional goals. You know, so for example, we're intending to move in this direction, and sort of it's a point on the horizon. And so, you know, that's an important thing to do. That's setting the vision and direction of the company and everything else. How much of that, you know, how far we're going to get in that direction, how much everybody is going to rise within that context remains to be seen. But we don't have to say we're going to go in, you know, we're going to go towards growth, and our ambition for growth is, you know, pick a number, $20 million, right? Well, if we pick 20 million, there's a, you know, maybe there's a good chance we'll hit 20 million. But there's probably not a big chance we're going to hit 30. I can actually remember I was in corporate America for a very short time. But I do remember people actually saying they don't want to exceed their goals, because as soon as you exceed your goals, then you just get bigger goals for the next year. And of course, you have to like build on what you accomplished in the first year. So it's better to just hit your goal. And then if you think you can do better, like hold that in reserve for the next year. So I don't know that it serves so well. You have another framework around that as well, right?
Yeah. I think this is Marshall's aspiration, ambition, and action, that your aspiration is the higher purpose for being and doing what you do. And this is something that's completely unachievable. It's meant to be so lofty and so big and this higher purpose that never really gets accomplished in your lifetime. And that's okay. And then you have an ambition, which is something that you maybe you do want to accomplish. And that might be a more measurable goal. And then the action is, what are you doing each day? What steps are you taking to move you in that direction? And I find that that's a really helpful piece, is that you want that, but you want that aspiration to be something very lofty. And then again, I find that what the coaching process does, it is actually helps with the action piece of that, helps, you know, make something that feels very, let's say, big and out, you know, far in the future. And it makes it feel a little bit more present, because your coach is serving really, in many cases, as an accountability partner, and just asking you, what are you taking those actions? Are you making those steps in the right direction? And amazingly, over the course of, you know, 6 months, a year, a few years, a lot of clients look back and they say, wow, I have really moved quite a bit in that direction.
Yeah. The amount of transformation people make, I mean, that we are fortunate to, you know, be observers of coaching and the impact of coaching. The amount of transformation that happens through coaching is just extraordinary. I mean, catches us off guard all the time. The speed, the, you know, people who go into a role, they're preparing for a role, and the company's unsure whether they're going to be ready for it. And then through, you know, a coaching intervention, within 6 months, they're not only ready for the role, they're accelerated into the role. And sometimes they leapfrog into another role, even higher than that. Because, you know, there's so much potential in most leaders, I think, that, you know, you just can't unlock all your own potential. You need that support of an outside person whose only interest is you. You know, there's no real, I don't think there's a really good replacement internally within the organization for an external coach, right? Because everybody within the organization has some sort of competing interest within the organization. They're hired by the organization. They're, you know, if they're a mentor, they certainly have your interests in mind, but they also have their own job. If they're a peer, they may be competitive with you. If they're somebody who reports to you, you have some degree of leverage over them. It's, you know, it's complicated. That world's complicated. The coaching relationship is uncomplicated, right? The coach, and as you said, a coach has to be willing to be fired. That makes it even less complicated. But from the coach's perspective, the only thing that matters is your success. That's the whole job of the coach, is to make you successful. Nothing more, nothing less.
Beautiful. Let's go back to 3 and 4 of the openness framework. And then I want to talk about flourishing.
Sure, sure. I'll do 3. So just to recap, I struggled with being open to change. Jacqueline struggled with feedback. And getting over those two hurdles, it's like, that's a big job. That's a lot. But the third part of the openness framework is a willingness to take action. Because if you're open to change and you accept feedback, but you're not going to do anything with it, then you're not really coachable. To be really coachable, you have to be open to change, get the feedback, and then say, okay, here's what I'm going to do. with that information, because coaching is all about creating that positive change, that forward momentum, creating that growth. That is the great return on investment in coaching, isn't lip service, it's action.
Yeah.
And so the third part is taking action.
And then the final part is, action is good, change is good. But what we care most about is lasting change. And so being open to accountability, which is our fourth piece, is also a really important part of the process of becoming coachable, because really accountability is a lot like feedback. It's checking in to say, have you made the changes that you wanted to make? And for most of us, certainly myself included, accountability from another person is really key for me to do anything consistently. So, just as an example, I for years, like many people have said, my New Year's resolution is I'm going to go to the gym more and I'm going to get more in shape. And, it wasn't until one year when I hired a personal trainer where that change finally stuck, because I realized I was paying for this trainer, whether I showed up at the gym or not. So it was the thing that got me to go to the gym every Monday when I really didn't want to go. And after a while, I kind of transitioned that. Now my husband is that person where if I don't go to the gym unless my husband goes with me. He's my accountability partner. And so we set times every week to just go. It's just that repeated accountability and building mm-hmm. that muscle. It just takes time and it takes repetitions. But it's so easy to backslide, to go back to old habits and ways of being. And so that's the final piece in this. Of course, coaches are great at accountability, but
accountability partners anywhere.
Exactly.
I wasn't great at accountability. I think that's my weakest part as a coach. I think I was fairly snobbish about it. I'm like, my job is not to make you dependent on me. And I think I went for many years. I went too far. And then there were people coaches who were asking like, hey, can we just talk every day? I'm like, what am I talking about? Like, what are we going to talk about every day? And I said, no, just 5 minutes, just to check in. So what for? She says, just so mm-hmm. I can tell you what I'm going to do today. But you already know what you're going to do today. Why do you need? I need to hear myself say it. And I'm like, okay, I get it. There's this thing. It's not glamorous. It's not the part of coaching that, it's not winning the slam dunk contest. It's just being there and allowing the other person to speak out loud for themselves and for me. It took me a long time to really get that.
Mm. Super powerful.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing, Howie.
Yeah. Marshall wrote a book called Triggers just about that. And he created this sort of methodology called Daily Questions. And it is literally what you described. You find a friend who calls you up and asks you questions that you have written that you answer, but so you can't fight with anybody about anything about the process, right? You wrote the question, you give the grade. But just hearing that every day, really can change almost anything.
Right. Right. I mean, of course, in the course of coaching, we all have these moments where we have flashes of insight, where things are different. We've realized something powerful and it changes the way that we are. And that's, those are wonderful moments, very fulfilling. And I think those are, normal in the course of a coaching engagement, mm-hmm. but really most changes in life are the ones where we have to intentionally make that change and just keep taking one step at a time, one day at a time. And if we have a day where we fall short or we didn't live up to our intention, we just, let that, forgive ourselves, let it go and realize that tomorrow is a fresh day. And we set out on that intention again. And I think that's really part of how great leaders are made.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. So I have a couple minutes before we have to head out. And I just wanted you to talk about the last part of the book is about a distinction between like what's the goal, and people can sort of try to strive to take things for themselves and be successful. They can try to rise with the organization, or they can flourish. Can you talk what is flourishing? What does that mean to you?
I'll use a metaphor because I think that it really paints the picture. That if we were going to, you wouldn't ever describe a single flower in a field as flourishing. And if all the things around it were struggling, right? You can only look at a field of flowers and say that it's flourishing if everything is flourishing, right? And more flowers in the field doesn't diminish any others. More flowers creates, you know, attracts more pollinators and more life to be in that field. And again, it just, so it creates more for everyone and everything. So, and every single organism in that field is better served because the things around it are doing well as well. And that's really what flourishing leadership is all about, is it's that leader who taps into and recognizes how powerful the collective is. And when we're all doing well, how much better we can do together. Yeah. You know, so, you know, so many people are interested in themselves, right? It's natural to have self-preservation or self-interest. And that's on what we often see, especially someone who says, I want to rise for my own benefit. I want more authority, influence, whatever that may be for them. But when someone realizes that, by putting essentially other people's interests into the mix and understanding the vast impact that they have on the world around them and creating a better environment for all, that's what we're flourishing. Right.
This was really our favorite part of the book. We had written the first two sections of the book. Our intention was to write the first two sections of the book. And then we finished writing those two and we kind of put it down. We went, this is good. But then we realized but there's something else that we really want to say. And that something else was this idea of flourishing. And in the process of thinking about flourishing, we came up with this notion that what is flourishing? It's moving from me to we, right? It's moving from thinking about ourselves to thinking about everybody. And it's also a movement from taking things out of the system to creating more in the system. And so in the book, we create this 2x2 square where in the bottom left-hand corner, we call the leaders strivers, which are people who are in it for themselves, taking things out of the system. And then in the bottom right-hand corner, we have the people pleasers who are, you know, they're in it for others. They're pleasing other people, but they're still taking things out of the system. And then in the upper left-hand corner, we have the rising leaders, which are really most leaders who still are worried about what's in it for them, but they're creating expansion for everybody. And that's pretty good. But the ultimate ambition is this flourishing leader who can put their own needs aside and recognize that if they create more for everyone, they're going to create more for themselves naturally. But the focus is going to be on creating expansion. And by everyone, we really mean all stakeholders, shareholders, their families, right? If they're extracting from their family in order to serve the shareholders or the stakeholders, that's not good either. It includes the planet. Because if we're not recognizing that all elements of the system need to experience the expansion that we can create, then we're diminishing the system. And so that's what flourishing leaders are all about. I think at the end of the day, that was the reason we wrote the book.
I love the metaphor of the flower in the field, because when you, you know, my understanding of ecology is that every species either flourishes or dies. There's no species that says I'm going to extract, except for humans, and you know, who knows how long we're going to keep going along that track. But there's, you know, there's no species that's extractive, that survives, that passes the crucible of evolution, and no species that's only out for itself. Like even, you know, it has to create more value for all its neighbors, all its relations. So I love that's how you bring the book home. The name of the book is Becoming Coachable. What's the subtitle?
Hang on, we have it right here.
Unleashing.
I love that you don't have it off the top of your head.
Unleashing the power of executive coaching to transform your leadership and life.
Awesome. And for folks who want more of Jacqueline and Scott, where can they find you online and follow you and gobble up more wisdom?
Yeah, well, there's certainly 100coachesagency.com.
That's 100coachesagency.com.
That's where you can find sort of everything about the agency and us and our work. We both have LinkedIn profiles. I have a LinkedIn newsletter. and becomingcoachable.com is a resource for people who are interested in the book and everything about the book.
Great. So the .com is just the title of the book.
Yep.
That's right.
Yeah.
Very, very well. That's very elegant.
Thank you.
Jacqueline and Scott, thank you so much for writing the book. Thank you for the smiles that we have shared today and hopefully the wisdom that's going to be useful out in the world. And it's just a treat to connect with you.
Likewise. Thank you, Howie.
And that's a wrap. You can find the show notes at plantyourself.com/580. That's 580. So Movement News just got back yesterday from, or 2 days ago now, from Alicante, where the Spanish second division beach ultimate tournament took place. My team did fantastically. We came in 16th out of 25. We won 2 out of 4 games the first day and lost the 2 games in our championship round, playing for 13th place. So we did get 16th, and we had a good time, and we were a lot older than the other teams, so it felt really good to run with the youngins. It also felt really good to see how the game has evolved and how the youth players have so much more skill and strategic understanding, and they were really nice to us old folks. So a lot of running, a lot of smiling, and hopefully I'll be able to keep playing. You know, my joints really thank the beach sand for being gentle on them. I did better than I thought because I was recovering from some sort of nasty bug that included a persistent cough and a sinus infection and a head cold. So I hadn't really worked out for about 2.5-3 weeks beforehand, and my lungs were still kind of recovering. So today I had a training session, did a lot of beach sprinting and boxing and conditioning, and hopefully can get things back up. I think there's another tournament at the end of April, a one day in a town called Sabadell, north of Barcelona. So hopefully I will be running faster, harder, with more of a smile on my face then. I think that's about it for right now. I have some sort of tax issues that I'm working on around, you know, becoming a tax resident of Spain, figuring that stuff out. But I don't know enough to be anything other than dangerous, so I'm not going to share any findings with you here, except to say always an adventure. So I look forward to seeing and talking to you again soon. As always, be well, my friends. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons, Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Maurer, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatterley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filkinowski, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkis, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Benham, Gil Assert, David Donahue, Blair Cyborg, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Bandana Chali, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Lakoski of Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iaconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty DiMartino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Paranganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends.